It was such an honor to have Lori Hall Sanderson, an authority on finding and analyzing historical documents, join me on the Everything is a Primary Source podcast so the two of us could discuss the power of primary sources. Lori has made a career out of working with primary sources. Her bibliography of nearly 30 books for children and young adults includes several historical fiction titles, and she is adamant about using the documents and artifacts that she researches fully as a way to project as much truth about the past as possible. I'd like to welcome you back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. I'm Eric Paul, and I'm so glad today to be joined by a wonderful author, an author that I've seen in person several times, more than she realizes, actually, because my wife and I kept sneaking around and spotting her in different locations all around the country. This is New York Times bestselling author and award-winning author, Lori Hall Sanderson, and she has written several books. Would you say that Speak is where it all started, right? That's the book that I published.
But the next book you're going to talk about probably is Fever 1793.
Yes.
Which I actually had been working on before I wrote Speak, but
it
needed a lot of drafts.
So it's kind of like a Stephen Crane type thing. He's known for Battle or, the Red Badge of Courage, but he was working on Maggie Girl of the Streets, you know, a little bit before that. And, you know, that showed up after the other one. But so, we're going to do things a little bit differently today on this podcast. Normally, what you're all familiar with listening to is hearing myself and a guest talk about a piece of media, a movie, a TV show, a book, and breaking it down as a document of its time. And we'll do a little bit of that as we talk about some of Lori's books. But since Lori Hall Sanderson writes a lot with historical fiction and history in general, we are going to be talking about the process and where to locate primary sources, what to do with them once you have them at your fingertips, which you were saying earlier that is getting easier and easier to do, right? Have them right on hand. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is super fun. And I'm like a ginormous nerd. So like talking about primary sources for an hour just sounds like a good time to me.
Me too. So, you know, in recent years, and we have a connection that, you know, we have some roots years deeper than mine in central New York. But when I was living in Oswego, which is just north of Syracuse where you were, I lived right across the street from the Oswego Historical Society and the museum there. It was incredible. Mm-hmm. They had all sorts of great stuff. And I remember talking with, I was doing a project one time, and I was talking with the docent there, you know, the head of the department, and he was a super interesting guy. And he was telling me, and this is probably like 2003, 2005, somewhere around there. Mm. He said, you know, we're very cautious about digitizing things. Yeah. He said, even at that time, the Smithsonian wasn't relying completely on it, that they were, sure, taking pictures of stuff, but they were not going all in on computers. Things have changed a little bit in the last 20 years, though. Have you found that computer sourcing, finding primary sources online, has that gotten a bit more reliable? Is it something that you feel more comfortable doing nowadays?
Well, the short answer is yes. The long answer will take up the rest of the hour. I'm glad you brought up the word reliable, because I think one of the most important things for our students to learn these days is a really healthy sense of skepticism. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that information, even especially with AI coming into the picture now, is easily manipulated, easier and easier to manipulate. And when people are manipulating things, I mean, sometimes they're just being jerks.
Yeah.
But usually they have some sort of motive or agenda behind that. And it's often you can't tell, you know, if you can even figure out if you're being manipulated, you have to do like so much more research to figure out why are they messing with me about this?
Yeah.
So figuring out where the reliable sources are, for example, Library of Congress.
Yes.
And even then, I have a good story for you. Because the Library of Congress has digitized, bless their hearts, not only the original correspondence between George Washington and the early Congress, as well as Washington and a bunch of other people, mm-hmm. but you can look at both the digitized handwritten letter, but they've also had somebody type it, you know, so it's much easier to read. Mm. But yes. I found that sometimes the people who did the transcriptions made mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I realized, I was like, oh, shucks, now I have to go back. So whenever I can, even with a transcription, I always try to find the original source mm-hmm. to make, because people are human. Then people do make mistakes, along with some not great people trying to manipulate us. So going to institutions that you trust, Library of Congress, I think, has got to be pretty much up near the top. George Washington's home at Mount Vernon, for example, mm-hmm. It's been fascinating to watch them develop. You guys need to know that I started researching my first historical novel, Fever 1793, in 1993. So I've been able to watch a whole generation of scholars come of age, as well as technology improving. Yeah. And our understanding of, are we going to rely on the Victorian interpretations of the American Revolution, or are we going to recognize that they were imprinting their own social values on which stories they told?
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons why, you know, I worked hard on this book. It's a book for younger kids, but it's stories about 88 women and girls who were active players in the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of stories that the Victorian historians, you know, that they wouldn't look at. So anyways, yeah, I'm really off track already. Sorry.
No, but that's exactly what happens. This is almost like digging through the stacks, you know, yeah, of a library
yeah.
of,
yeah.
You know, you go down one path and you hit something good mm-hmm. and then it brings you somewhere else. You know, I oftentimes tell my students that one of the best places to find your primary sources are secondary sources.
Yes.
You know, that you are, and that's, you know, before we hit record, you held one up for me from 1993, and that's what mm-hmm. prompted the investigation of and writing your book, Fever 1793, is that, you know, so if you go to reliable and, mm-hmm. you know, that's the tough part. It's like that first barrier
right.
is the toughie, is like, okay. And, you know, the question I have my students ask, and, you know, I have it on a form. I have, mm-hmm. I teach all my classes with basically three pieces of paper. One is a homework sheet that just says, right. what's your question? And then it has the a section for the primary sources that you collected and mm-hmm. the secondary sources that mm-hmm. you used. The secondary source form we usually start with, because I say, all right, first thing, what kind of secondary source is it? Who made it? Mm-hmm. What is their connection to the subject? Because mm-hmm. you can go to a library, and in that library, you can have like the, you know, those like books that are made by, you know, nobody in particular. They don't have authors' names on them. It's like the biography of Tupac, you know, or, yeah, you know, right, just like right. random. Yeah. And it looks like they just took Wikipedia and printed yes. it out and, you know, slapped it mm-hmm. into there. You know, if it doesn't even have an author, then you can't possibly connect, you know, you can't give them any credit right. for it. Or, right. you know, if you have a book that's written by a music historian, somebody who, you know, knows and, you know, maybe wrote for Rolling Stone or is, mm-hmm. you know, deeply connected to the music industry in some way, is a hip hop special, and they write a book mm-hmm. about Tupac Shakur. Mm-hmm. That's the one that you should start with, right?
Right.
Go there, because they right. are showing you that they're going to take the time. And any good secondary source has to have primary sources to back it up.
Yeah.
You know, all those Ken Burns documentaries. And he does make some mistakes sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll have mm-hmm. somebody, you know, reading a letter
right.
while they're showing an image, and they don't actually go together. But you can usually, you know, yeah. his entire presentations are all primary sources, basically.
Right.
So like, that's a reliable source, and that's where you should start digging. So then they start digging and digging, and then they come across the primary mm-hmm. stuff. And mm-hmm. that's where it turns into one thing leads to another. Thank you. I think I asked you this question years ago when it was either for Forge or Chains. I forget which one.
Okay.
But I think I asked you when you are writing history fiction, do you let yourself get hung up on a primary source? Like if you are, all right, I need to base what I'm writing on fact. I need something from the time period to write about. Do you ever find yourself hitting a major obstacle by not finding the right thing that, to write around?
Yeah. And people who write historical fiction for adults are lazy sons of guns. And they make up things often where those of us who care about kids and care about kids' understanding of history, we're held to an appropriately higher standard.
Yeah.
And the first example that jumps to mind is my book Chains, which is mostly set in New York City, the summer, winter, fall and winter of 76 into 77. And it's the story of a young woman held in slavery and her younger sister and a friend. And I had a really strong opening and I'd done all of this research. And then I was pretty sure I knew how the book was going to end, but my middle was just so flat because I wasn't finding, this is when I was living in Oswego, right? So, so I was researching this in, I think the book came out in 06. So in the early aughts, so long before a lot of these, there was a lot of documentation that you could access online. And in Oswego is not so much the center of historical research in New York State.
Right.
And I didn't have a lot of money to travel to New York City very often. So I was like, so what I finally did is I gave myself a couple of weeks and I drove into Syracuse every day to the Byrd Library, which is the Syracuse University Library. Yeah. And I found the microfilms of the newspapers. And I just read the newspaper for every single day of my story.
Oh, wow.
And because there had to be something going on. I mean, I knew like that the British moved in, but none of the secondary sources at that time that I had read, that I had consulted to try to understand that world of New York City in 1776, none of them mentioned the ginormous fire that burned hundreds of homes that was probably set by the Patriots. And in the right smack in the middle of my book, I leapt out of my chair and yelled in glee, which got me a lot of dirty looks, but there it was.
Yeah.
Then I was able to find letters that people were writing out of the city to people in the city about their experience with the fire. And I knew I found the map so I could figure out which buildings burned and which direction the wind was blowing and how that would affect the lives of my characters. And suddenly I had a middle of my book.
That's wonderful. And that's such it goes back to what you were saying before about, even the secondary sources that seem the most reliable, and they are, they're totally great. They're wonderful. But history has a history too.
Yes.
History can be, the history books, I left them at school, but I brought in three history textbooks for my students to look at. One was from 1867. The next one was from 1889. The last one was from 1900. And they all share very similar qualities and just the layout, the way it's written and very, it's like, it's basically like, if you read that, you'd think that like the only thing that's ever happened in American history is wars. It's like, and then a bunch of, a war. And like that was like the direction of it. But it's like, that is a historic document of its own. And the lack of, it's just like a photographer. You have a lot of power over what people see based on what you take a picture of. So if you are writing history and there's a fire that Patriots probably set and your audience for the history is Americans in, maybe like 1876, like 100 years later, the centennial. And you're like, I don't want to make these guys.
We're not going to go there.
We're going to go. They're heroes. Like these guys are all great. And it's almost like the books of, I was just talking to a student today about this with And, you know, it makes it seem like I have like this incredible, you know, I think I just go around annoying them with little factoids, but Kenneth Roberts, the mm-hmm. author from, mm-hmm. he's
from Maine,
you know,
right?
30s. Yeah. He's from mm-hmm. Kennebunk, Maine. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he wrote a bunch of books in the 30s, primarily including Northwest Passage, you know, about Robert Rogers. And he wrote, so a number of his books in that era were about people like Robert Rogers, these you know, usually like loyalists, mm-hmm. Tories, mm-hmm. You know, of course, Robert Rogers pre-Revolutionary War. So that right. was French and Indian War when right. everybody, but it was like, that was, you know, going against conventional wisdom, you know, yeah. and maybe that says something about the 1930s that, you know, hey, look at this. We're in this Great Depression. Maybe everything that we've been living up to wasn't exactly great. And,
well, exactly. You have a generation of Americans who were disappointed, who just yeah. came through that, you know, those were terrible years.
Right.
And so it's like, were willing to do some interrogation that was overdue.
And they ended up using that story, and they made the movie out of it with Spencer Tracy, which is basically an hour and a half of pro World War II propaganda. You know, it's like, yeah. you know, and that's the project the kids were working on today, is they were taking movies from the 30s yeah. and showing how they were primary sources of the 30s. And that, and the kid chose he did it on his own, but he found the right scene where you see Rogers Rangers on one side yeah. of the fort at Crown Point and British soldiers on the other side, and they're facing each other because they're on the same side right. and the commanders are walking. And I'm like, it's 1940 when this movie comes out. Right. Britain's at war
yep.
alone. They really, really want, and there's plenty of elements in the United States who really would like us to do more mm-hmm. than just sell them a bunch of, you know, yep. ships and stuff. What do you think? What side do you think this, you know? So, yeah, you can go and you can look at the history as well as the pop culture. You can look at it all, and it's just documents, you know, even the. So tell me a little bit more about that article that prompted this, because 1993, that's on the cusp of the information age. That's like right before the internet really takes off commercially anyway. And so, you know, it seems like the work that you've done in writing, especially history, has kind of basically grown up with the internet, hasn't it?
Absolutely. In 1993, I didn't have the internet. It was a couple of years before we got our first dial-up. And even then, you know, Gmail, email hadn't been in, wasn't right. widespread yet. So here's the article that was in an old-fashioned newspaper, the newspaper that I used to work for at one point, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a great artifact for your own history. And it's an article that discussed a museum exhibit in downtown Philadelphia, where I lived then, where I live now, about the 200th anniversary of this terrible epidemic. Mm-hmm. Yellow fever epidemic that killed thousands and thousands, digging mass graves, serious kind of. Mm-hmm. In Philadelphia that summer, they didn't know how yellow fever was spread. They didn't know how to cure it. Sounding a little bit like COVID, very scary yeah. times. I was drawn to it because I like gross medical things, but also because I was really, when I read this article, because I'm a big history nerd, I was like, why didn't I know about this when I was a kid? This is because Philadelphia was the capital of the United States then. We were a yeah. little tiny baby country in 1793. Washington was president, right? And Hamilton was in town, and Jefferson was being a pain in the neck to everybody. And they all left during the epidemic, right? So I was just so fascinated to read about early Federalist America, just these new days in this new country, and this terrible thing happens. And the thing about terrible things is that they bring out the best in some people and they bring out the worst in others. So I, there was nothing online, because online didn't really exist. So I had to go to my public library to look up where I could find historical documents, primary sources. in Philadelphia, we have the Historical Society of Pennsylvania downtown. And people in Philadelphia, they really dig history, Liberty Bell and all that. So everybody holds on to their grandmother's letters. So place is a treasure trove. And I went down there. I would put my kids on the bus and I would grab the train and head downtown for months. And I was looking at things like this. Can you see that?
Yeah.
That's a photocopy from the historical that, you know, you can get them. You're not allowed to take a letter and put it on the Xerox machine. But this is one of the letters from John Welsh. And he was this kid who he wound up. I actually had to do some research for his life because I wanted to make sure he survived, and he did. But he was like a 17-year-old boy who worked in the equivalent of an early grocery store. And his boss, like most wealthy people, left town and said, John, you're staying here. I need you to mind the store. And I want you to write me a letter a day and tell me how things are going on. You know, and so John would write him these incredible letters that would give the gossip and the rumors and the details. And then you have to imagine me, I'm in this archive. Then I'm taking notes in my notebook because laptops hadn't been invented yet. Mm-hmm. So doing it, you know, fourth grade style here. And I'm turning the page and all of a sudden this man's handwriting, which is pretty nice, was a scrawl. And I was just aghast because I was so entranced by this man and this kid and all this bravery. He had gotten sick. He had come down with yellow fever. And strangers took him in and cared for him. And it was just, and I found so many different kinds of sources that told that story over and over about people who were disrespectful and not nice to others and people who were really open-hearted. So that experience was my experience of learning the power of primary sources. Which for me are not just documents. One of the most important ones I found was a map of Philadelphia from the time period. And for most of my historical books, I've found a map of the time in the right place. And I've been able to blow it up ginormous and then put all my different scenes and things on it. So I understand the geography of the place.
It must be, and you're the only person that can really do this because it's your story, but it must be so incredible to be able to go into that world so deeply. It's like traveling time.
It truly is.
Philadelphia and everybody holding on to things. We could take Philadelphia as a primary source right now and say, well, you know, this is really the city where the Enlightenment arrived in America. Thanks to Ben Franklin, because he goes to England. And he's like in London, he's like, oh my God, these people are like sharing their ideas with each other. They're, you know, open about, having these conversations in coffee houses. And then he comes back to Philadelphia and he's like, I'm going to do this here. Right. Yeah. And he starts applying all those. And like you said, it was the first capital. It was the place where the Declaration was written, where the Constitution was written. Mm-hmm. It has so much there. So, of course, I'm sure that radiates for most of the public there of like, hold on to your stuff. You know, like we are a historic place.
Yeah. And when you find things, people share them. But, you know, it's interesting, even for as you know, and there's lots of great universities in Philly and we have Valley Forge just down the road from Philadelphia. And I set a book there. But I was still able to find in my research for that book some things that have been in, they had their own archive at Valley Forge back then and where people had donated stuff. And I was able to find a letter that was written from Valley Forge that had some details about some of the people who were held in slavery, who served the officers who were at Valley Forge. And the kind of detail that I've never been able to find anywhere else. So there's still, you know, you think, wow, it's been almost 250 years. Everything's been explored. No, there's a lot still out there.
It's so great that you cover, especially with 1793, because especially back in the, strangely, the 90s, but you know, for a very long time, that whole era was kind of glossed over. You know, you go from, in most history texts or just in, you know, normal people's understanding of history, American history, they go from, you know, Revolutionary War, Declaration of Independence. I think a lot of people have this idea that the Constitution was like the next day, you know, not 11 right? years after the Declaration of Independence. And then there's like this vacuum. There's just nothing for
until the Civil War.
Right. And it, even like you might get a little bit of peppering in of 18, you know, it's like, oh, the new century and, you know, Washington, the city is being created. But like that interim era, that early federal period, which is so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of historians actually say that the revolution was not complete until 1800. You know, it wasn't until the election when the party changed, you know, from Federalist to Democrat Republican, that the actual revolution was successful because they were able to change power peacefully.
You
know, that was the key to their success that way, you know, because a lot of people, and I can be a stickler about this with my class. I'm like, look, the revolution, the Revolutionary War are not interchangeable terms. The revolution is the big period that you have a beginning, usually 1763, and then, you know, with the end of the Seven Years' War.
Right.
And then the end would be 1800, 1801, you know, when Jefferson takes office. And so it's like that's the revolution. The Revolutionary War was a major part of it, but it's within that era. It's like it's the expression of the ideas put into action, I should say. And that's why it's like, you know, imagine had this yellow fever gotten completely out of control and turned into a larger epidemic, spread to different cities and claimed the lives of the leaders of the new country. I mean, that would have, you know, probably brought the country, you know, pretty down pretty quickly, you know.
My theory has always been if the British had been paying attention, and they were a little busy over there in Europe in 1793, and France was doing its thing, that's when they should have invaded then, and they would have taken us over again easily. Yeah. Philadelphia was so weak. We really didn't have the army's kind of a mess, and everyone's still trying to figure it out. One thing though I want to bring up, and that is the new book that I'm working on, which is set in Boston in 1776, because I'm so irritated that Johnny Tremaine ends as the war is beginning, right? Johnny Tremaine, by the way, written in the middle of World War II, also a great piece of anti-German propaganda. When I started to research into the lives of the real people who were in Boston during the British occupation and then immediately after, I get curious about people like I did with John Welsh when I was researching Fever. I wanted to find out who was he as an adult, right? He wound up being amazing. He wound up being an incredible businessman, had a huge family, great wife, and he endowed a chair at the University of Pennsylvania School of Business. This was the kid who minded the store during the pandemic. But in Boston, I was able to see how close the American Revolution was to the Civil War, because there were grandchildren of people who were in their teens and early 20s in Boston during the Revolution. Their grandchildren fought in the Civil War.
Yeah.
That's living memory.
Right.
That's like a heartbeat. And I think this happens too when you get older. It's really, really hard, I think, when you're young, because your brain's still growing and you don't really have this concept yet of time. But our country is so young.
It is.
I would argue, by the way, that the revolution's not over yet. That we are, because my definition is that Declaration of Independence, which made this promise that we're all going to be treated equal, which has obviously been interpreted differently in different time periods. But the way I interpret it, we're still working on that promise.
Yeah. It is this is like going through like everything I've been talking about in like the last few months, you know, to different people about different things. But I, you know, I can kind of like, I think about the Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, in which, mm-hmm. you know, even just the placement of where the speakers were that day, looking, yeah. you know, at the feet of Lincoln, and even that memorial is a primary source. You know, 1922, yes. they issue, yes. and he's looking back towards the Capitol, back to Washington, you know, kind of like, yep, I did my job, you know, held yeah. this place together. But yeah. there's Luther King, you know, looking out towards Washington, you know, monument with, mm-hmm. you know, slave owning Washington.
Yep.
At the feet of the great emancipator. And he says yeah. that. He says four, you know, he even uses the term score in his opening of his remarks.
Yeah.
Looking at the Capitol with knowing JFK is off to the side. Oh, y'all are mm-hmm. listening. You know, and he refers to that. He said, you know, these, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were promissory notes.
Yes. Right,
we're here to cash a check, mm-hmm. and 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, mm-hmm. this entire March on Washington and the speech itself is mm-hmm. a measurement. It's saying yeah. this is where we are. And then, you know, go back to 1848, Declaration of Sentiments. You know, yeah. the women who put that together, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she did that intentionally, word for word, pretty much, of the Declaration of Independence, because she recognized that, I mean, every kid yes. from 77 onwards had been right. memorizing that, and yeah. they knew it. It was pop culture for the time period. So they're like, mm-hmm. okay, you know, yep. and that's why everybody's, when she's reading it off at, you know, at the, in Seneca Falls, they're like, whoa, like yeah. you went far. But it, that's a, and the last thing that I'll bring up is when it comes to the Civil War. So Barbara Fields, the historian, she's on, you know, Ken Burns' The Civil War, and she mm-hmm. makes a point in the last episode of that documentary. She said, well, a couple things, but she said the Civil War, that's when the country was really born, because, you know, the Constitution, mm-hmm. in other words, you know, as terrible as it was, we needed the Civil War to really kind of baptize the country. You know, it was all just kind of like theoretical
in blood,
but that's what made it. And she mm-hmm. then she said the Civil War is, it wasn't a was,
yeah.
it's always there.
Yes,
and it's, it it's always, and that's why, I mean, that's why Ken Burns made the documentary. It seems random, 1990, like that's right. not an anniversary year of the Civil War.
Right.
It's not even, right. you know, but he makes it because it's like, we need every generation
Yeah.
to be familiar with how terrible that thing was, yeah. so we don't descend into it again. But I like that that approach that you just said, that we're not, and maybe we're never meant to be complete with the revolution, you know, from that it's intentionally constantly being strived for. And every generation has a responsibility to touch on it.
This is a great experiment, our nation.
Yeah.
This experiment in democracy and these promises, the promissory notes that said we all have rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we still don't have that codified properly in our laws. And you can see the progress is always met with a backlash, right? And then you have a little bit more progress, always met with a backlash. And that when you compare our culture to cultures in other places in the world that have had the capital city there for 500 years,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, just a little bit, we're still quite young, and it's been hard for me to be hopeful last couple of years as I see some of our institutions under attack, but that's why I love writing for younger people, for teenagers and kids, because yeah. they get it. They see the world. They understand. And, you know, by helping them, it's so cool that you're teaching them the tools, not just the facts, but to be a successful adult, to be an adult who contribute to our nation and contribute to your community, you have to have the right tools to interrogate and investigate and analyze.
EverythingHistory.com is not only the new home of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, it's also where you can find details about the services I offer.
As you know, this podcast is an extension of the instructional method I created. I would love to present it to fellow social studies educators. There's also my podcasting offerings as well. Whether it's creating or refining an audio program for your school, museum, town hall, library, or business, or if you'd like to have me host a podcast karaoke session for these venues or both, everythinghistory.com is your destination. All services can be carried out in person or virtually, so don't hesitate to contact me and schedule your session today. Everything-history.com. That's everything-history.com.
Term fake news has been tossed around a lot in the last couple of years, and you know, it's about detecting, you know, and I think using primary sources, like I said before, is one of the biggest, you know, the proper use of them, the proper presentation of them, is when my red flag starts to go down, is when it's like, oh, this person is using these properly. Right. They know what they're talking about. You know, they're able to present evidence, you know, in a couple different forms. Okay. You know, that I'm going to listen to this person. I'm going to give them my, but when it's just tossing out randomness and like pointing at the, and not even knowing what you're talking about, you know, that's I'm like, you know, but that's kind of where I'm headed. You know, that's why I love doing this podcast, because it's taking irregular sources of history, you know, things that, you know, I kind of see it as almost like I'm stumbling through a junk store or something. And I'm like, I ran into this shelf and off came this 45 record from 1962. All right, this tells us something about the past. And then I go over here and there's a bunch of old magazines from, you know, the 70s or something. This one will tell us something about the time period too. But
can I tell you about some primary experiences?
Yes. And I was actually going to ask you, tell me some of the best like moments in your research for various books.
When I was researching Forge, that was also, that was completely written up. And I lived in Mexico when you saw me in Oswego that time. So I lived just down the road.
And for listeners, New York. That's a town in New York, right? It's a very small town.
Hundreds of inches of snow every year. I was researching Forge, and I kept on reading in these letters that Washington was just writing these furious, heartbreaking letters to Congress about the condition of his poor soldiers, which many of them, if they were alive today, they would have been in high school. These are people in their teens and early 20s, poor kids who had no opportunities. And then this promise that we're going to make a new country sounded great. Let's go. Except there was no food. Especially in Valley Forge, especially in the beginning at Valley Forge, supply lines weren't great. The guy who was the quartermaster guy was terrible. He had to get replaced. The weather wasn't good. A lot of the guys didn't have boots. They had been marching for months and they didn't have boots. They were like they had to build their own huts. They were in tents in the snow. And then they would trade off boots within whoever had to go on duty. But Washington kept on writing to Congress, and he many times used this expression, "My men are leaving bloody footprints in the snow." And I read that and I was like, George, come on, man. That's exaggerating. And Congress must have known you were exaggerating. You blew it. You went too far with that. But then I saw it from there was a doctor. What was his name? Albegintz Thatcher, I think was his name was. Great first name, Albegintz from Connecticut. And he mentioned the medical conditions and bloody footprints in the snow. So I'm living in northern New York, and I wait till it's a winter day. Everything's frozen, tons of snow and ice in the ground. And I dressed as a Revolutionary War soldier. I had breeches that were just down to my knees. I had thick wool socks. I had kind of a linen shift and a wool shawl and a cap. And I went for a walk with my husband, who was completely dressed like a normal person. And he thought it was a very bad idea. And I walked for, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And my husband was grumbling the whole time. And And at first I was like, I'm just walking. It's okay, you know? And then my socks got wet because, you know, the heat from my feet, and that was cold. That was not very comfortable. And then my feet started to hurt. You should not do that. Don't tell, let your students do this, by the way. Then I started to get the tingling, the sharp pains that you get when you're starting to get frostbite.
Yeah.
And that was when my husband getting, so we're starting to get a little worked up. And then my feet went numb. And that's when I realized how they were able to leave bloody footprints in the snow. Because these guys had to go on duty.
Yeah.
They had to chop down trees. They had to patrol. They had to go foraging. They had to carry their sick buddies to the hospital tent. And it was great when your feet got numb because then you didn't feel the cold. No British soldier killed anybody at Valley Forge, but thousands of men died. Many of them would get cuts on their feet and not notice it. And then they would get infections and that would kill them. Mm. So that was really, and that was just like this, he wasn't exaggerating.
Yeah.
There were bloody footprints in the snow. Another thing I did was, I read about the men had gone to a farm and it had snowed before. This is when they first got there and they were digging in the snow to see if they could find anything that hadn't gotten harvested. And they were able to find some small pumpkins and they roasted them. And just, you know, such, it was like the first real food they'd eaten in days. So I did something like that. We camp up in the Adirondack. So that was an easy thing to do. So those kinds of trying to live and talking to reenactors who for the most part are very careful about their own primary sources and, you know, learning how to do the cooking and learning what the smells of the environment is and the sounds. That's super fun.
That's a world that has altered a lot too with the chimes. I know for a while it was just kind of like, you know, if you go back 100 years or so in the midst of the colonial revival movement, it was just dress up like, you know, powdered wigs and it looked like, you know, a modern Halloween costume kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then, and then I know for the Civil War, like 1960s had the same kind of thing, you know, where you could get in the Sears catalog.
Right.
I think one of my favorite books is Confederates in the Attic by Tony Horowitz.
Yep.
And he, you know, talks about the hardcores, you know, the guys who... you know, 80s and 90s, they get so wrapped up with it that they're like, no, we need the authenticity. We can't just, you know, it's not enough just to pretend for a weekend that we need to, we owe it to these guys almost, you know, and it's like, sounds like the same thing, you know, for the soldiers of Valley Forge that you kind of owe it to them.
Absolutely.
To at least experience a few minutes, if nothing else.
I
did a little bit of not quite reenacting, but I in here in the seacoast of New Hampshire, we have a living history museum called Strawberry Bank.
Oh, I know that place. It's lovely.
It's wonderful because it's very dynamic in that each house is a different time period. So it's not like so many of the other places, which are also great, where it's just one era.
Right.
And I was in the 1777 tavern.
Ah.
And I actually, when I got to do that job, you know, so I was the son of the tavern keeper and he was supposed to be 22 and I was like 35 when I started doing it. So
yeah,
I didn't tell people when I was born very often, but I went to the Athenaeum in town to do some research and it was wonderful, you know, and this is like a year or two after I'd started doing it. And I found the guy's name. And like he died, it just had nothing. It was like, cause like the family he belonged to is a very, you know, pretty high status family in the city. Mm-hmm. They, and their tavern was the biggest in the city. It was the most, you know, well-known. They were accused during the early days of the after the war broke out. And actually in Portsmouth, it was even earlier because of the attack on the fort there in December of 74 of being loyalists. They they assumed because the father, the you know, the patriarch of the family was from England himself, and he and his brother had started the first mail, basically the post line between Portsmouth and Boston
about
20 years earlier. In the stagecoach, they were the first to like, conceive that, and his brother had gone back to England a couple years before. So they're like, okay, here's strike one. You know, we don't even play baseball yet, but there's strike one.
Right.
You know, strike two. And then he had put, you know, early, a couple years ago, he'd put some British officers up in his hotel even though he had to, but they were like, people were just using that against him. So the story of that place, you know, was all about, you know, in 1777 dealing with being an accused family in a city, but then another layer on top of it, that the family was a slave owning family. So they had servants that worked in the tavern, and at least 3-4 times a day, I'd have to tell the story about the riot that took place with James, the servant, being sent out by my father to go deal with the crowd.
Oh, gosh.
And then, you know, he hit a guy over the head with an axe.
Oh,
you know,
man.
Not the, like, the blunt side. And just knock
the other
him
side,
out.
Yeah.
You know, and then the dad was put into, and it's funny because that same story, when I was kind of piecing that together to get ready to do the, you know, my interpretation of it, there's a story that comes from Brewster's Ramblings on Portsmouth. It was like late 19th century. And actually, I think even before that, it must have been before that, there was Thomas Bailey Aldrich, who was a contemporary of, you know, Mark Twain. And he wrote a book called The Story of a Bad Boy. And it was like the predecessor to the boy books of, things like, Huckleberry Finn and stuff like that. It was, you know, it doesn't really have like much of a plot. It's just kind of like, here's a bunch of stuff I did as a kid growing up in Portsmouth. Yeah. And he lived in the house right next door to the tavern. And in fact, it was the youngest son of the tavern owner who built that house.
And so
he had this, like, it was, the whole neighborhood's all just intertwined, connected. It's wonderful. But he, in that book, tells the story of the tavern, and it has like a cartoonish quality to it. And they even have a drawing in some of the books of this, like, rotund, you know, like cartoonish looking tavern keeper running out the back door. And then Brewster writes his version of it, which is just as silly and ridiculous. But then there's a copy of a book that I have called On the Road North of Boston. It's all about taverns and turnpikes in New Hampshire. And that one tells a story, but guess what it has? It has primary source evidence. It talks about Captain Wheelwright entered into the tavern and noticed a commotion. And, you know, Mrs. Stavers said to him, you know, and it's all the language from the era. And I'm like, this is the legit version. And then we have papers from, you know, because they moved the capital during the revolution, Revolutionary War from Portsmouth to Exeter. So in Exeter, they have all these papers, these court papers. And the way, then I'm doing all this digging and stuff. And I'm like, I think this guy was set up. I think this whole thing was Sons of Liberty or some, you know, wannabe Sons of Liberty group, you know, because it was right after Princeton, is right after Trenton.
Right.
They were there and they were intentionally trying to rile things up. They weren't regulars in the bar. They were getting people going and singing all these carols about Washington and stuff and trying to provoke, because they knew that if the, you know, tavern kicked him out or something like that, and that's why it, and they, the dad ended up going to jail, and it was like an incredible, huge amount of money that had to be posted to get it. I'm like, that was a fundraiser for them. They just used this to collect some money.
That's a great way to put it.
You know, for the, you know, because we have this idea of the Patriots, like anybody on that side was all benevolent and good. And I'm like, no, I think they were after, they wanted to, you know, tarnish this family's, you know, name and raise some money at the same time, maybe even close down the whole thing. So as an interpreter of it, as I'm me, it's so hard. It was so hard to like not bring up all the, because like I had to tell myself, and this is the training that the role players get, they're like, you have to know certain things, but you have to not know other things. You know, a normal person wouldn't know all those details. They have chores to do around the house sometimes. I wouldn't be able to like, well, you know. But it was just such an incredible, I think we had a shared experience in that I got to, whenever I worked there, dress in the outfit, you know, everything, and just immerse myself into 18th century. And I felt like I was, it was nice. You know, I could detach myself from the modern world for a little while. But I did use elements of the way the actors portrayed life in the coffee house in mm-hmm. the Fever play that I watched.
Ah.
So when, because that was a couple years before I'd watched right. those, and right. I loved the way that they, and in the book, you know, it makes those 18th century people so much more accessible. They seem like real people, you know, like,
yeah.
you know, this gentleman that you're talking about that as a kid was watching the store, like, I'm sure in his writing, it's using vocabulary from the time period, but he comes across as a young man who is, if he lived 100 years later, he would be similar. And it just kind of, yeah. you know, so these people, I guess it's a roundabout way of saying primary sources do a wonderful job of illustrating for us the reality
mm-hmm.
that, and the reality is people don't change all that much. We are very similar in our ways, even if we are able to talk to each other through a computer screen. You know, it's like we're all the same.
The emotional content of the lives of people, that doesn't change. How it gets expressed in language and action, and if it's accepted or not accepted, those are the kinds of the institutions that surround people's lives and either enrich or damage them. The institutions change, and the institutions themselves are reflections, not of the current generation, but of usually two generations previous. One of the things that shocked me when I looked it up once is I was born in 1961, which is a little while ago. And my grandfather, who was the oldest grandparent I had, he was born in 1899. His grandfather was born in 1829. So everybody can imagine their grandparents, right? I have grandkids now.
Yeah.
And so it's really, I've got so many great memories of my grand, and they told me about their lives. And so I got that from my grandfather. But what he was getting was the world of the early Federalist period in the Adirondack Mountains. And his grandfather's grandfather was a Revolutionary War soldier, four wow. generations, or four hops, more than four yeah. generations, but from grandparent to grandchild four times. And you're there.
Yeah.
And so that's why, like, on the one hand, I get so frustrated when I see, for example, that we, 100 years before we could have the civil rights movement that could even begin to do some of the work of creating a little bit of equity and justice for people who aren't white in the United States, 100 years after that war. And we're still not there. But on the one hand, I'm so impatient and looking at primary sources helps me understand that we can only live life at the pace that we live it and recognize that all the feelings that we have always been there. And I think maybe that's as a storyteller, what I'm trying to do in my books, based on as much factual data as I have. And I don't know if you know this, but I have all of my books are reviewed before they go to press by college professors who are experts in the time and place to make sure that I haven't messed anything yeah. up. So as much as I can, I try to get the facts down. But to create worlds using the words and knowledge that I've gotten from primary sources that will show people like you and me and your students and my friends and their kids in that time period with the opportunities and restrictions of that time period and how the human heart played out on that stage.
Do you ever feel, and this kind of goes back to what I was looking at before, but do you ever feel, because there is such a responsibility that you mentioned about writing for younger people,
mm-hmm.
that the older people, like, I don't know, I just happen to have this book here. if you're writing for adults, I don't know if you're familiar with Harry Turtledove, but I mean, I'm sure it's not his real name, but, like the alternate history fiction stuff
yeah,
where
yeah,
it's just like, yeah. you know, yeah. you can be a lot more loose with that, you know, if yeah. you have an adult audience. But you were saying exactly. for young kids, you really need to be
yeah.
like solid.
Yeah.
Is it ever like, do you ever feel like, oh man, I don't have a primary source for this? How long can I go with just my own critical thinking from primary source to the next one that I am I running a risk of interjecting too many of my modern sensibilities, my modern feelings in between these two things that I know are landmark facts, like actual reports from the time period.
Right. Well, I don't write books like that.
Right.
And I guess the trick is, I mean, and I'm thinking of some books that that people have written about cultures or time periods that weren't well documented. And I just think you have to in your note to the reader or in your back matter of a novel like that, you have to come clean about what you knew and what you couldn't know because of the lack of materials and so yeah. where you made things up. And I do that too in my back matters. I'm clear about what was real and what was made up. But I try not to do it. For example, the book that I'm working on Boston right now, I've gotten better as a researcher, which means it takes even longer for me to write a book now. But and now we have spreadsheets. God, I love spreadsheets mm-hmm. so much. So I have a whole bunch of spreadsheets that I made from my own research. And I've got a couple hundred pages of small mini biographies of people who lived in the world that I was talking about.
Okay.
And as much as I could, I tried to document what they were doing during the occupation and after the occupation. And then I can borrow details because I know that somebody similar to this character was doing this at this time and place. So, for me, I guess I'm kind of picky about what I want to write about because I don't know how to do this without really great primary sources to work
yeah.
with.
Yeah, you're just not comfortable with it. Is what you're
no,
saying? It's
no.
just like yeah,
it would be disrespectful.
I've tried my hand a few times at writing stories, and mm-hmm. One activity I do with my students that's it's limited for them. I usually keep it within, one class period, but I'll give them a primary source or I'll have them find one and then have them write a story where either the primary source itself, whatever documented there, a photograph or whatever, is either the beginning, middle, or end of their story. Like they have to write a creative writing
thing out of that.
And I've kind of dabbled in that on my own, mm-hmm. but that's where I get frustrated is like, I don't have something to pick this up where my own imagination leaves off. I don't have a definitive yes or no to where I want to go with this. So that's where I give up on it. Cause I'm like, I just don't, I'm a teacher. So summertime is when I would have the most time to do this.
Right.
And then, before I know it's August 9th, 29th, I'm like, can't get back to that writing thing again. But I think about those, and the author's names escape me, but there's a train of books that came around the bicentennial. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. My brother Sam is dead.
Yeah.
And the Winter Hero.
The brothers.
Yeah.
The Collier brothers.
Yes. Yep. It was brothers or brother and sister. I think siblings at least. Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I read one about that's set during Shay's Rebellion. Called The Winter Hero. And
oh, I don't know that one.
That one does a good job. And my brother Sam is Dead might do it too. I just remember I read that one more recently. And in the back section, because I love Shay's Rebellion. That's something mm-hmm. else that's totally mm-hmm. glossed over.
Yep.
Unless it's appropriate to do so. And got a quick story about that in a minute. But at the back of the little novel, the paperback, it does do something what you're just describing. It says,
right.
This is based on, there are accounts of, one of the things that happens in the story, there are accounts that this did happen. And mm-hmm. so we intentionally dramatized the way that Shay's Rebellion came to an end for the purposes of storytelling. Like it didn't actually, it wasn't quite as dramatic as the way we made it out to be. But mm-hmm. We were out, my wife was at a conference at the or workshop at the Eric Carle Museum a couple years mm-hmm. ago in Amherst, Massachusetts, and that's Shay's Rebellion zone, Western Mass. And so I had my little boy with it. He was only like three at the time. A hot summer day, but we went out and I stopped by at the Chamber of Commerce, and I was just like, do you have any good Shay's Rebellion stuff around here, mm-hmm. like good, and this lady, the lady at the front is like, oh, I don't, and this lady leapt out from behind her cubicle and she's like, Shay's Rebellion. And she starts, she's right. like, oh, it's, and she's like, you got to go here and there. I ended up driving out to Petersboro or something. Uh-huh. And there's a little meeting house there with a bunch of graves of these guys who were in Shay's Rebellion.
Wow.
And there was a police officer sitting there, at the, you know, he's doing his, you know, watching the traffic. Mm-hmm. And I went up to him and I'm like, hey, do you, he's like, oh yeah, there's all those guys are buried over there. And there's the tavern over road. And then it's the tavern that's in the book, you know, cause it, and so it was wonderful. Cause I was able to like, I read the book a little later. I'm like, I've been to these places. I know exactly where they're talking about, but there's a big reservoir out there. Has a funny name to it. Starts with a Q, I think. It's a reservoir for Boston. And, the police officer is telling me, or so, no, actually, there's a woman at the Chamber of Commerce. She was like, Daniel Shea's house was out that way, but I'm pretty sure they intentionally flooded it out when they made the reservoir. It's like underwater.
Oh my gosh.
And so I'm like, that's like the ultimate, like, you know, take that guy, you know, who was trying to, and he wasn't even the true ringleader of it. They just put, they just attached his name to it because he was, you know, he had officer of rank during the Revolutionary War.
Right.
I love Shay's Rebellion because it's just such a cool, you know, it has so much interesting components to it that when you look at it, it's like, yeah, they were kind of asking for trouble by not electing a representative in, you know, in the legislature.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they were just trying to, it was like the ultimate populist moment. You know, it's like after the Revolutionary War, they're just trying to make ends meet, trying to pay their bills. They can't keep having their houses taken from them. And they're like, what the, you know, so much for this.
Why do we
great,
fight that war?
Like, what do we get out of this? Cause I'm not getting much respect here. It's like Rodney Dangerfield. And, you know, imagine him in the Revolutionary War.
Right. Oh my God.
You know, so that was like, I love that. And then it repeats itself with the Whiskey Rebellion, but because it's on either side of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'll wrap things up a little bit here because you're talking about Boston and during the Revolutionary War and the way that that is recognized and documented in that city. I just wrote a Substack essay a few weeks ago about this because we were down in Concord for looking at – so whenever we go to Concord, we like to do Orchard House, which in itself is a primary source of, and I wrote about this in the Substack because, you know, when they opened it up in 1911, you know, people kept coming to the house, be like, we love Little Women. And, you know, the people like, go away. And they're like, oh, wait, hey, can you pay us some money? Come on in, you know, but like the next year and, immerse yourself into Little Women. And then just around the corner is North Bridge. And on either side of North Bridge is the two monuments, and you know, one of them was dedicated in I think 1840. It was like a random year. It wasn't you know, because it seems like after the Civil War and definitely into the 20th century, we start as a society and culture marking things with even numbers. You know, we love our, you know, the centennial 1876, the bicentennial 1970,
right?
You know, every 10 years or 20 years, 25 years. They didn't really do that in the 1840s. And so that's where Ralph Waldo Emerson gives his Concord hymn. You know, like they sing the Concord hymn at that. And that's where he gives that term, the shot heard round the world. And so it's an obelisk. That's the, you know, it's just a very basic, you know, because Revolutionary War, there's not a lot of memorials to it from that generation. That just was not part of their ways. It took a while. And then after the Civil War is when they have the dedication of the very famous Minuteman statue, which was made by his last name is French. He was actually May Alcott's student. You know, so, you know, Louisa May's sister was his tutor in artwork. And he also did the Lincoln Memorial that we were talking about before.
Right.
So he makes this thing and he uses one of, he uses the lines from Emerson's, and it's on the other side of the bridge. And that is a very recognizable, it's a statue of a man. He's a Minuteman. He's holding the rifle in one hand and the plow in the other. And that one was done in 1875. So mm-hmm. it's like after the Civil War, when we went from becoming, as you know, Shelby Foote puts it, he's like, we went from a R to an is. The United States R to the United States is. By the time we get to an is, it's a collective history. They're like, it's the centennial of Lexington and Concord. We need a legit statue. We need to have this thing. And we're going to borrow the words from that Emerson guy. You know, he's like, I'm still here. You know, we're going to borrow his words. We're going to put it on the statue. And it's going to be on the other side of the bridge. The bridge, you know, the side that the colonials were on. And it's, and then like, at that same time, that's when the British monument was put up too. The little memorial to the dead British soldiers was put there too. And I'm like, this is all just, it's a little triangle of primary sources. It's like each of these different eras has its own, you know, imprint on the way we learn about that one single event. And it's so interesting. And then the city itself. How much you're willing to give away, but what is the general kind of theme of the new book?
It's so the book opens as the bombardment of Boston was from the other side of the Charles River. So because Washington needed the British to look that way, so they could drag those cannons that they had taken from Fort Ticonderoga, they could drag them up to Dorchester Heights and in one night establish that fort. Astounding, astounding work. So that's how that's when the book opens. So the first kind of quarter of the book is the evacuation. My main character is a serving girl, and things are complicated. But what really struck me about Boston, when I was originally supposed to do a picture book about Abigail Adams, and I just couldn't find, and I had this contract for years and I couldn't find a new hook. She's been written about so much and she left us so many great primary sources. But then when I got COVID in 2020, I thought, wait, I know a little bit about Abigail getting her family inoculated against smallpox. And they fudged that wicked in the John Adams HBO series for the record. So I started to investigate that, and I realized that right after the evacuation, there were two things going on that really intrigued me. One was because Boston is ignored after the British leave. We don't really study it. But you had loyalists, like super loyal loyalists who had been super happy that the British had been there, living often with their family members who were patriots. And they had to begin the process of figuring out how to get along. Mm-hmm. One of the really important primary sources I read, which really has not wound up being so much in the book, but it was an important thing for me to understand about the mindset of the adults in the time period, was there was a committee of correspondence that was Tory hunting. And they were bringing in I was able to read the testimony of a 13-year-old serving girl who was asked to testify about the behavior of the man who was the master of the house, and was he a loyalist or not. So strong political opinions, very divided. And then, because history always repeats itself, smallpox epidemic was really getting out of hand in the region. And finally, after being begged to do this, the Boston selectmen in early July allowed for inoculations to be practiced, because they had to give you were not allowed to inoculate without permission, although people were doing it all the time. And so thousands of people flocked to Boston from the countryside because they were desperate to get inoculated, as well as the army regiments that were still remaining there. And the town turned into one great huge pox party. In the middle of this, on July 18th, when everybody's pretty much everybody is contagious, And if you didn't want to be exposed to smallpox, you had to leave town because everybody was contagious. And it was much safer to get smallpox because you would get sick if when you got inoculated. You would get a mild form of the disease. But again, like we just saw in the last couple of years, smallpox was a known disease, but inoculations were new. It was first done in Boston in 1721 based on knowledge that came from a man who was enslaved in West Africa. And he explained it to Cotton Mather, and then Cotton Mather did some research, and then actually was an ancestor of John Adams, a Boylston, Dr. Boylston, who did the first inoculations in 1721. But you have this scary disease.
Yeah.
And you have science that people don't understand. And while all this is going on July 18th, at the State House, from the balcony in the State House, is the reading of the Declaration of Independence that had finally gotten to Boston from Philadelphia. And everyone in that crowd is about to get really sick because they've all been exposed to smallpox. Right?
Like, so, what are you talking about?
So it, to me, it's a mirror. It's a mirror of what we're going through today. But it's also me looking at class structure, a main character who's living, serving people who are wealthy. And just, you know, it's a story about being 13. Being 13 is always hard.
Yeah. No matter what era you live in.
Yeah.
And,
right.
You know, especially when the weight of the world is on you at that age, in that time period. Yeah. You
got
so much going on. It's, you know, that is, I'm looking forward to reading this, because I think you're right. Boston is so forgotten about after the British evacuate, you know, it's just like, seems like it's like, you know, and New England in general really kind of gets the, you know, the heave ho from, you know, both sides. There's like, you know,
the
British
try
to cut it off the next year, you know, with, you know, to, you know, for a variety of reasons, but it's never really quite the centerpiece of the thing. So, you know, I think one reason perhaps is it seems like we kind of cycle, you mentioned the John Adams, you know, mania.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I think we cycle through founders and framers so often is because every generation, maybe even less than a generation, has every couple of years, we have one that we can identify with a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, the John Adams in the early 2000s, you know, seemed to kind of match the interests. Mm. And then Hamilton took his place a couple years later. And Hamilton mania still might be going on a little bit now, but who knows who's next? You know, it's hard to say, but whoever it is, if there's anybody that would be able to do the research, it would be Laurie Hall Sanderson. So thank you so much for joining me on the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. It's been just so much fun talking to you. And I'm glad we didn't do it the traditional way, because that would not be taking full effect of the Laurie Hall Sanderson experience. You have so much. I'm looking at the bookshelf behind you. I'm like, every single one of those has, you know, the ones that you've written, especially, are just like, there's so much effort put behind it. So, you know, into getting it right.
You know, the truth of this, I'll just leave you with this. If somebody would just pay me to do research, I would never write another book. Because I actually wound up having to write the book to justify all the time I spent on the research. Just brings me such joy. It's so exciting and so interesting.
It's you go from one thing to the next, and it's like the best, you know, mystery or, you know, detective work ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just,
precisely.
You feel so satisfied, and, you know, it's just, you feel like you give, like you said before, giving people from the past the dignity they deserve.
Absolutely.
You know, especially in an era before photography, when images have not been with us, you know, it's like you get to just bring them back to life for, you know, for a while. So on behalf of everybody, thank you for doing it for so
long. My pleasure.
But thank you, everyone, for listening to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, where everything, including everything we talked about today, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time.
My wife and I used to jokingly refer to ourselves as Hoss Heads, because there was a 5-year span of time where it seemed like we were seeing Laurie Hall Sanderson at author talks and book signings every few months. And not in the same place either. from central New York to the Delmarva area to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and back to the capital region of New York, we partook in discussions, photo ops, and signings, even seeing the stage version of Fever 1793 in her native Syracuse at one point. And there's a reason why Laurie's work appeals to two people with degrees in history and literature. She knows precisely how to tell a story, set in the past, with the accuracy the real people of those time periods deserve. It is especially important that her work serves young people, as these future Halseheads benefit from a role model who demonstrates such strong stewardship of history. Well, season two may be over, but the Everything is a Primary Source train isn't slowing down. I'll be hosting a pair of podcast karaoke's coming up in about a month, one virtual for the Society of Commercial Archaeology's conference in Erie, Pennsylvania, and then the next day live in my hometown of Portsmouth, New Hampshire for the 400th anniversary celebration on June 3rd. Right around that time will be the start of Part 2 Palooza, where the second parts of episodes from the second half of Season 2 will be published. You can access them today by subscribing to epspodcast.substack.com or going over to Patreon, patreon.com/epspodcast. There will be plenty of posts on the Substack as well. And don't forget about everything-history.com. That is the home base for this podcast, as well as my podcast coaching services and my social studies education consulting services as well. Everything-history.com. There will be enough EPS content coming your way to bridge the gap until Season 3 launches in September. I will certainly be spending that time, especially in my travels, garnering topics and guests. But if you have suggestions for either, send me a message at epspodcasthost@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at epspodcast, the EPS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and, like I said, the website, everything-history.com. I hope that you listen to all the shows during the summertime, and I look forward to having you back again for Season 3 to the EPS Podcast, where everything, including Season 2 of the EPS Podcast, is a primary source.